to Shattering Myths. I am your host, Yetta. Each morning here on GCN, we expose and condemn the destructive myths associated with religion and politics, with patriotism in the media, and with military and economic schemes. If you listen, we'll open your eyes and hopefully change your mind towards each of these things upon which most people foolishly cling. Instead of merely presenting the news this morning, my mission will be to help you understand what is occurring behind the headlines. We will reveal the motivations of the perpetrators and share what you can do to protect your family, all while predicting how these events will shape our world over the next 20 years. Then during our second hour, we're going to engage Yahweh on his terms by way of his one and only covenant and through his always dependable Torah teaching, so that with God's guidance, you will be able to replace religion with reason. Our number for those who would like to engage in this discussion, to affirm or criticize anything you hear as part of this program, is 877-376-45. You know, it's interesting. The first item amongst the items in the news this morning was America still lagging behind many nations in test scores, particularly in mathematics and science. I brought up a number of those stories from a number of news agencies to see what the results actually presented. And what I found is a lot of rhetoric, but no charts. And not a single one of the sites that that were cited in these stories actually brought up the chart on the test results. It's kind of as if the so-called journalists with the New York Times and others thought that since people have lost the ability to think, they would not be able to interpret the numbers on a chart, that they would be far better off with some rhetoric that says, you know, we scored this and this compared to that in that country, and then another country over here, and this is the trend over there. There wasn't the ability to look at the data and ascertain trends and interesting information based upon the actual data itself. A lot of, and that story just is, it kind of resonates with what's wrong with us generally. We, as a people, have become so lazy and our minds so flabby and unexercised, we are not accustomed to examining the raw data and then interpreting and making connections from that data so that we come to understand. It is a failure, I think, in rhetoric, in logic, in the ability to think rationally, or just the ability to think. It's one of those things that is no longer taught in school. Speaking of school and teachers, there was a fellow named Tarek Massoud, who is an associate professor of public policy at the Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government, that was making the rounds last week on all of the television talk shows. Oh, yes, he is full of himself. And I would normally just ignore a talking head that provides a conversation for television talk shows, because you don't get invited on those talk shows unless your position is politically correct. But in this particular case, his position was so politically correct, so conflict with the actual evidence and what reason would lead one to conclude, I thought this might be an interesting report. And so it is an article that he wrote on behalf of CNN as part of this publicity campaign for his new book that I'm going to be citing, because it is insightful, but in a very negative sort of way. He was speaking about the turn of events in Egypt. Now, if you recall, a week ago, when we were reporting on Mohamed Morsi taking on dictatorial powers, I said specifically that he won't hold them because he doesn't need to hold them. All he was attempting to do was to get the Supreme Court from usurping the will of the people, which in Egypt, as an Islamic country, 75% of the voters voted in on behalf of the most fundamentalist Islamic candidates. When you realize that 10% of Egyptians are Copts, Christians, and you take them out of the equation, it's well over 80% of Muslims that voted for the most fundamentalist candidate, which is all that does is underscore what I've been telling you for years, which is that the vast majority, well over two-thirds of Muslims are fundamentalists and therefore are pro-jihad. Now, this being the case, all he needed was to get the new constitution, which establishes a theocracy, a government based upon Islam, for Islam, where Allah is the head of state, and where the most influential Islamic institution in the country, Al-Jahar University in Cairo, has final say on all interpretations of law and the constitution, and that the constitution will be based on Sharia. All he has to do is get that passed, and it doesn't matter whether or not he is a dictator, because no one can challenge him or Allah, which is more important. As it as a reference to that, however, this individual, Mr. Tariq Masood, has an entirely different take. Now, he begins with a quote that was insightful, but he then contradicts this person's view. He writes, 20 years ago, Edward Jarajin, a former U.S. diplomat, famously worried that Islamists would exploit democratic elections to come to power, after which they would pull the democratic ladder up behind them. Instead of one man, one vote, he said, Islamists wanted one man, one vote, one time. Now, that is an extraordinarily insightful conclusion. And it's almost precisely accurate. So this U.S. diplomat, 20 years ago, now that's 10 years before 9/11, the vast majority of those who have begun studying Islam only have done so in the last 11 years. If this was indeed 20 years ago, he beat us by 9 years. Now, what he recognizes is that to make this prediction, that Muslims were growing progressively more fundamentalist. Because if you were dealing with liberal, secular, mundane, kind of washed out Islam, this would never occur. This only occurs if you're moving towards Sharia, if you're moving towards Salaf, which is fundamentalist Islam, if you're moving in the direction in Egypt to what we call the Muslim Brotherhood. So he recognized that trend long before anybody else was even taking that temperature. Next, he had to recognize that because they were the majority and because they were essentially the only influence in those countries, the mullahs and their mosques were the only credible, you hate to use the term credible and associate with Islam, but the only influence, organized influence within these countries, other than the dictators, that if the dictators were deposed, the only source of information for the vast preponderance of illiterate people would be their mosque. And in the nature of Islam, he had to recognize that the imams would use this opportunity to tell their parishioners that they either acquiesce and vote for the most fundamentalist Islamic candidate, or that Allah would roast their britches in hell. And, of course, they would do so. So that's, again, incredibly astute for someone to be able to predict that as far out as this individual did. And so what he predicted is exactly what the United States made possible in Iraq. One man, one vote, put in an Islamic theocracy that is controlled by the mullahs in Tehran. It was the most suicidal thing America could possibly have done, because this man's understanding was not passed along to the rest of those in the U.S. government. Now, as it relates to the Islamist wanted one man, one vote, one time. He's almost right there. The only difference is that they'll continue to vote. It's just that there'll be no opposition. You know, mullahs in Iran continue to have votes. It's just that they don't matter. There were continuous votes in Russia. There are votes in China. It's just that they don't matter. There are votes right now in Russia. They don't matter. And the reason they don't matter is because the controlling entity, in this case Islam, but in others, the leaders of that government, in Russia it's a fascist government now, have total control over all of the media levers. And they have control over all of the judicial levers. So if someone is a viable candidate, they're put in jail. If a movement emerges, they're not given access to any media. If they use social media and they attempt to hold rallies, they're imprisoned. That's exactly what happened in Russia. So there is no viable confronting candidate. And that's what happens in Islam. That's what Mohammed Morsi knows. The moment the Constitution is that was written by 100% fundamentalist Muslims, I mean, they were only 75% elected, but all the others walked out, so it was only fundamentalist Muslims, so it only has window dressing for things that are not pure Islam. The moment it's in effect, he doesn't have to call himself a dictator. He has total power. Last week, Egyptian president, this is now from Tariq Massoud's article, last week, Egyptian president Mohamed Morsi, a member of the Muslim Brotherhood and his country's first democratically elected president, seemed to fulfill the Dijerijan's grim prophecy. Seemed to fulfill. Now, he actually fulfilled it, but not according to this great thinker at Harvard. In a series of unilateral amendments to Egypt's interim constitution, Morsi declared that his word is final and binding and cannot be appealed by any or by any entity, and that he is empowered to take all necessary actions and measures to protect the country and achieve the goals of the revolution. In other words, in Egypt, I am God. Now, we're going to return to consider the rest of this man's article because he completely misses everything that's important and turns truth on its head. I'm Yada. This is Shattering Myths. Back to Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yana, 877-376-45, if you would like to engage in this discussion. We are considering an article that was written by Tariq Massoud. He took to the airways on many, if not most, of the news stations over these past week to speak of Mohamed Morsi's claim to dictatorial power. And it was sad in that he started off with a quote from someone who 20 years ago predicted precisely what is happening before our eyes. And yet he says, no, that is not the case. He says, but this is now in the Harvard professor's words, but as shocking as Morsi's actions are, they do not prove that Islamists cannot be Democrats. You know, that is a very misleading statement. It is true that Islamists cannot be Democrats. One man's actions, however, don't prove that Islamists can't be Democrats. It's completely misleading in that statement. What proves that Islamists cannot be Democrats is the Quran and Hadith. Muhammad's words and deeds prove that Muslims cannot be Democrats. One man's actions thereafter, 1,400 years after Muhammad, don't prove them. It's just one more bit of evidence along the way that anyone who reads the Quran and Hadith comes to the undeniable position that Allah is opposed to choice. Morsi's decision to grant himself unquestioned authority was not the final, spectacularly public phase in some hitherto clandestine Muslim Brotherhood plan to erect a holy autocracy. Instead, the Egyptian president simply did what Egyptian presidents have been doing for more than 60 years, that is, loosening institutional restraints on their authority in order to more easily fulfill their agendas. Again, misleading. Mohamed Morsi is first and foremost a Muslim. That is who he is. And he is not just an average run-of-the-muck Muslim. When he returned to Egypt after having received his education at USC, Southern Cal, where he became a materials scientist. It's kind of the weakest form of engineering, and then went off to teach it as an assistant professor at Northridge. Upon returning to Egypt, he began to teach material science, which is this kind of weak form of engineering. And in doing so, he, because of the university setting, engaged in the Muslim Brotherhood. They dominate universities in Egypt. In the Muslim Brotherhood, he became the enforcer. He became the equivalent of Cardinal Ratzinger in the Roman Catholic Church. You know, Ratzinger, before becoming Pope, was responsible for a church doctrine. He was the enforcer. You either, if Ratzinger was on your case, it was because you were saying or doing something that was viewed in conflict with the most fundamentalist line of authority of Roman Catholicism. He would be the man they would send out against you. And that was Morsi's job in the Muslim Brotherhood. He was the enforcer. And in the Muslim Brotherhood, he was the enforcer of the most Salaf or fundamentalist interpretation of Islam. And anyone in the Muslim Brotherhood or anyone outside of it who did not hold to the most fundamentalist views was attacked by Morsi. That was his job. So, therefore, his motivations are Islamic. Fundamentalist Islam. That is his entire mindset in this regard. In fact, he's a fairly shy individual in terms of his public persona. He's only in this position because the spokesperson for the Muslim Brotherhood was disqualified from running because of his issues in the former regime where you can't have been a felon and run for office. And he was imprisoned by the former regime. So he was elevated to this position really on the last hour of the last day of the elections. And even then, chose not to campaign on his own behalf. He was simply the person underneath the Muslim Brotherhood umbrella. He never, ever stood out on his own. We'll return to this discussion so that you have a better understanding of what's happening in Egypt and the mindset behind the Muslim Brotherhood, and specifically why he demanded total control, dictatorial control, and why he subsequently gave it up, and why no one in Egypt even cares. Shattering Mists. I am your host, Yada. You can call us at 877-300-7645. The Harvard professor goes on to say that he writes that Morsi is an Islamist is largely irrelevant. The opposite is true. I mean, he has really created, craftfully, but an entirely false premise. He's made a bunch of statements that are extraordinarily misleading. For example, as shocking as Morsi's actions are, they do not prove that Islamists cannot be Democrats. What proves that Islamists cannot be Democrats is Islam. Read it. Examine its history. Morsi's decision to grant himself unquestioned authority was not final. It was just he says it was a spectacular public phase, but yet he said it is the final position of every Egyptian dictator. And so he contradicted himself on the next statement. And so what he's saying is that the fact that Morsi is an Egyptian is what causes him to be a dictator, not Islam. That's like, let's remove all of the cultural influences. Let's remove the thing that drives this man, his religion. Let's remove everything and say that somehow racially in someone's DNA, if you are an Egyptian, you have to be a dictator. Now, there's a reason that Egypt has been plagued with dictators. It's the same reason that Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and the United Arab Emirates and Syria and Jordan and Yemen and Libya have been plagued with dictators. What do you think all of those countries have in common? Oh, gee, Islam. Yet this college professor writes that Morsi is an Islamist is largely irrelevant. No, it's the only thing that is relevant. It's the one common denominator between all of these modern dictatorial states. It's likely that the autocratic temptation would have seized Egypt's president regardless of his party or ideological orientation. Again, absurdly misleading. You had a 0% chance of winning a democratic election in Egypt unless you are a fundamentalist Muslim. 75% of the votes, if 85% of the Muslim votes voted for the most fundamentalist candidates. So you wouldn't even be in the position unless you were a fundamentalist Muslim. This is not only because Egypt has a distressingly long history of powerful executives, it is also because at this moment in Egypt's political history, there is no actor, institution, or organization able to keep the presidency in check. That's not true. The military is, but the military, and we will never know what happened behind the scenes, but Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood evidently went to junior officers who wanted their time to shine and convinced the junior officers to turn against the senior officers, and Morsi removed the senior officers from power. And therefore, with the junior officers now beholding to him, he was able, for whatever period of time, to have some control over the military. He made them promises. For example, in the most recent concession, Morsi gave the military the ability to arrest and to prosecute, which in any other country would never have existed. But there's a backroom agreement between the military and Morsi. But the military has the power to do that. In addition, the Muslim Brotherhood has the power to do it. In addition, imams, professors, the clerics at Al-Jahar University and Mosque have the ability to do that. As a matter of fact, they told Morsi to relinquish his dictatorial claim, and he did so. So he's wrong. There are many institutions, including the Brotherhood itself, of which Morsi is just a speck, all have the ability to keep the presidency in check. Under such circumstances, this college professor writes at Harvard, even the most earnest Democrats would find themselves flirting with authoritarianism. And later, when pretenses can be dropped in the service of naked ambition. Once again, wrong. He's saying that it's just in the DNA of an Egyptian to be a dictator. That is absolutely moronic. It's in the words of the Quran. It's in the words of the Hadith. It's in the words and deeds of Muhammad that make it impossible for a good Muslim to advance free will. The Quran says that there is no choice for the Muslim because Allah has chosen their religion. The Hadith says that when a Muslim finds themselves under a general or a king, they must submit to them. Always submit to authority. Islam is the antithesis of Yahweh's Torah teaching, where God gave us free will. HaSatan, who is the model for Allah, wants to usurp it. And so, the very thing that causes the environment in Egypt today to be dictatorial and that model to exist throughout the Islamic world is the driver and is the one thing that he is denying. He writes, under such circumstances, even the most earnest Democrats would find themselves flirting with authoritarianism. The most earnest Democrats would never be in a position to flirt with anything because they would never win an election. Not in an Islamic world where 60 to 70, even 80% of the population votes for the most fundamentalist candidate because their mosque tells them to do so. Usually, presidential ambitions are tamed by the legislatures, and this was to be the case under Egypt's interim constitution. A parliament was elected in January, but the Egyptian Supreme Constitutional Court dissolved the body once it became clear that Morsi was on his way to being elected president. Not true. The reason that the Supreme Constitutional Court dissolved the parliament, which was elected to draft Egypt's constitution, is they could count. They realized that 75% of the members were fundamentalist Muslims, either they're members of the Muslim Brotherhood or the Salafist party. And therefore, they knew that they would be not only out of jobs, but out of power, because they were positioned to rule upon a quasi-secular constitution. And that would no longer be the case. And so, to save their jobs, they voted out the elected parliament. That's all that happened there. And it was because that parliament was fundamentalist and was going to impose not only Sharia law, but Al-Jahar University as the interpreter of all laws. The ostensible reason for the dissolution was the parliamentary elections ran afoul of some foggy constitutional provision, but the real reason was that Islamists dominated the parliament, and the court feared that the Islamist legislator, coupled with a Muslim Brotherhood president, would lead Egypt irrevocably down the road to theocracy. Yeah, that's true. That's why they banned it. And that's why Morsi took on dictatorial powers, was to undo their ban. In the absence of an elected legislature, it was left to the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces to run Egypt, and they did so for 18 months following Hosni Mubarak's overthrow. Then this goes on to say, but the Egyptian people and the generals had grown weary of each other. Word in Cairo was that the Minister of Defense, Mohammed Hussein Tantawi, wanted a way out, a safe exit in which he could live out his days free of the indignities visited upon his old boss, who was bounced between prisons and infirmaries. A bargain was worked out. The president clawed back the council's powers and set the Minister of Defense and Armed Forces staff into retirement. The political landscape now lay prostrate before him. Now, what's interesting here is that we don't know. We have no way of knowing what caused the Egyptian military to bow down before Morsi. We do not know. We will never know. But you can be assured that it was a power swap of underlings in terms of generals who were tired of not getting their time in the sun, and their agreed replacement of those generals directly above them. But how that worked out, we do not know. All we know is that just as Erdogan in Turkey has become a de facto dictator. He has done so by imprisoning and defrocking the generals. There is over 300 Egyptian generals now in prison. The highest ranking Egyptian generals are all imprisoned because Erdogan wants the rest of the military leaders to fear for their lives. And therefore, he has gained control over them and has become the de facto dictator. Very similar circumstances exist here in Egypt. There's also the realization that the biggest thugs in Egypt are very similar to Hitler's brown shirts. Hitler gained enormous power prior to being elected because of his private army. Well, there's a private army of the Muslim Brotherhood. We call them jihadists. They go out with clubs and Molotov cocktails and knives, and they bludgeon their opponents. And so the generals knew that so long as they stepped an inch out of line, that the Muslim Brotherhood could have them killed. And this, too, was a looming threat. One might be tempted, he says, to ask the United States, Egypt's greatest foreign patron, to help set that country on the right course. Some have suggested withholding aid, canceling loans, and other means of pressuring Morsi to step back from the authoritarian ledge. The United States never does that. We never withdraw aid. Once we have promised it, we never take it back. And these guys know that we will continue to supply weapons, we will continue to supply aid, even though we're aiding and abetting our avowed enemy. I am Yada. This is Shattering Myths. Back after the break. To the final segment of the news hour of Yada Yah program here is we will transition, I should say, to Yada Yah, to coming to know Yah in the second hour. But we're still amongst the process of shattering myths here in this hour. And one of the myths is being promoted by a professor of Harvard. He writes in his second to last paragraph, none of this, and then long dash. So all of the dictatorial issues, the lack of free will and choice in Egypt, none of this. Egypt's tradition of executive dominance, its feeble institutions, its weak political organizations, or its society is particularly the fault of the Muslim Brotherhood. So he's trying to exonerate the Muslim Brotherhood from what's happening in Egypt. Now, my concern here is the same concern that I have. In fact, I'm sending a bunch of emails back and forth with a fellow that either owns or runs Headline News. And I'm trying to get him to understand that he wants to blame Al-Qaeda for what happened, for example, in Benghazi. And I'm saying Al-Qaeda had nothing to do with it. You know, the moment you begin to focus on Al-Qaeda, you're missing Al-Qaeda's motivation. And you're missing the motivation of all of those other Islamic organizations that have nothing to do with Al-Qaeda, but share a common denominator with Al-Qaeda, which is Islam. Well, that is the case of the Muslim Brotherhood. And every bit of this has to do with Islam. Most of it has to do with the Muslim Brotherhood. But only because the Muslim Brotherhood is the most vocal and the most pure expression of Islam in that society. So all of this is the direct result of Islam, while not all of it is a result of the Muslim Brotherhood. And to say that none of it is the fault of the Muslim Brotherhood is completely erroneous. And so this person went through this whole convoluted circular path to come to his conclusion was that the Muslim Brotherhood is not to blame for the failure of Egypt's experiment in democracy. And that it was not the Muslim Brotherhood who wants a theocracy, and that when Egypt ends up with a theocracy, just call it a theocracy is a bit of a stretch since Allah is not God. But nonetheless, it's exactly the opposite of what he is presenting. And he has used convoluted reasoning and half-truths and outright lies to advance this erroneous conclusion. And he advanced it across the United States and Europe using the largest media outlets. None of this, he says, is particularly the fault of the Muslim Brotherhood. Well, it is all the fault of Islam, and the most vocal proponent of Islam in Egypt is the Muslim Brotherhood. So most of it is the fault of the Muslim Brotherhood, and all of it is the fault of Islam. In fact, this is his concluding paragraph. If we were to take any lesson from the turmoil on the banks of the Nile, it is not that Islamists can't be trusted with Egypt's presidency. It is that no one can. Morsi may yet reverse course, but odds are that he will not be the last. It will not be the last time that an Egyptian leader tries to convince his people that they must kill democracy in order to save it. Here's the reality. I predicted that Morsi would relinquish his dictatorial control, and he did. And I predicted that it wouldn't matter, and it hasn't. His opponents don't care that he has relinquished it, because his opponents all know, as I shared with you, that the issue was enforcing upon Egypt, imposing upon Egypt, a constitution that that gives all authority to Allah and his Quran, his hadith, to Islam, and that imposes not only Sharia law, but makes the dominant Islamic institution in Egypt, Al-Azhar University, the arbitrator of all disputes. That is what he imposed. That was his goal. He prevailed in this way. And so it isn't an issue of being in the Egyptians' DNA. It is strictly an issue of Islam's influence over a society. When you have a wannabe God who wants to impose his religion, his will, when he wants to act as a Lord so that you fear and worship him, so that you obey him, then you can never have an expression of free will. And that is why there has never been and never will be a democracy that has any legitimacy in the Islamic world. They are, choice and Islam, submission, are enemies of one another.
A little over a year ago, I began to do a lot of research into why, even though I had a pretty good sized meal, that I was still starving. And my research led me to a well-known fact.